Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
The Crisis Next Door, a weekly report on the biggest conflicts around the world, with host Jason Brooks.
Thanks for listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. White supremacist attacks have been on the rise. And while attacks in Pittsburgh, Charleston, and El Paso have focused attention on domestic groups in the U.S., there is a growing network of white supremacist terrorists across the world. And according to a new report from the Soufan Center, it poses a clear terrorist threat to the U.S. The Crisis Next Door welcomes back Colin Clark to talk about the rise in white supremacist groups. Colin is a senior research fellow at the Soufan Center and author of After the Caliphate, The Islamic State and the Future Terrorist Diaspora. Colin, thanks for coming back on The Crisis Next Door.
Thanks for having me.
The Soufan Center has released a new report titled White Supremacy Extremism, The Transnational Rise of the Violent White Supremacist Movement. Let's talk about that transnational rise. Where are we going there?
Sure. I mean, we're talking about a threat that stretches from Canada to Australia and from the United States to Ukraine. This is a global phenomenon, much as the jihadist movement is. And for far too long, we've considered it a domestic issue, hence the label that's often applied in certain attacks, domestic terrorism. We've considered it of local and parochial concern. And all along, there have been transnational connections in this growing network.
And while it does stretch to all corners of the world, Ukraine, as you mentioned in there, is at the center of all of this and its years-long war against Russian-supported separatists in the Donbass. How has this civil war aided the growth of white supremacism?
Well, again, to make another comparison to the jihadi side of the house, civil wars serve as an active battle lab for terrorist and insurgent groups, and Ukraine's been no different. In many ways, it's allowed groups like the Azov Battalion, which is one of the most prominent neo-Nazi groups fighting in Ukraine right now, to reach out and recruit foreign fighters, to bring them over to Ukraine, to train and to radicalize. And, you know, this is a movement that's in need of manpower and recruits, again, much like the jihadis. And so this is a phenomenon that's been unfolding before our very eyes for years.
Are the white supremacists fighting for one specific side in the Ukrainian civil war, and where are the foreign fighters coming from?
No, in fact, they've been, they're fighting on both sides. They're actually fighting with the Ukrainians and against the Ukrainians. So it's really interesting. They've been fighting with the Russians as well. Our report goes into some of the numbers that we've seen, and I'll just give you a quick rundown of the top 10 where we've seen some of these foreign fighters coming from: Russia, Belarus, Germany, Georgia, Serbia, Moldova, France, Croatia, Italy, and Austria. But there's many other countries as well. 17,000 foreign fighters in total. But I just would like to clarify something, because I'm not suggesting that all 17,000 of those foreign fighters are indeed white supremacists. However, there, just as we saw with the jihadis, individuals that go over and fight in these conflicts that may go over for all sorts of different reasons. Some might be legitimate white supremacists. Others might be going for a sense of adventure. Yet others are looking to go out of a sense of peer pressure because their friends go. We see that kinship networks play a prominent role. But actually being there on the ground and fighting alongside these groups, they may very well come over and radicalize and turn to that side. So we don't know. It's very murky. We do know that this is a major issue and one that's largely been ignored.
Are these separatists sprinkled throughout different forces? You mentioned the Azov Battalion. It's of known repute. Or are there other specific groups that center on this particular ideology, such as what we see in Syria with various jihadist groups?
Yeah, so Azov's certainly at the center of this constellation of groups, but there's a number of other lesser-known groups that are active. And moreover, we've got to be careful about lone actors as well. And so we see individuals that go over, fight, and then return back to the United States seeking to do harm and you know, maybe kind of on the outskirts of these networks. We've seen prominent American neo-Nazi groups like the Adam Waffen Division and the Rise Above Movement, RAM or RAM, active in this space, going over, training with Azov and others, attending UFC-style mixed martial arts fights together, and doing the kind of bonding and you know, that we've seen foreign fighters engage in throughout time.
It's easy to lump terrorists into one group, whether jihadists or WSEs. We'll use that occasionally for white supremacist extremists, just to shorten that phrase a little bit. But as we've seen with the jihadists, there are very different ideologies fueling these various groups. Is that the same for white supremacists?
Yeah, very much so. And you know, it exists along a spectrum, right? Some are less committed. Some are a lot more hardcore ideologues. And again, this can kind of change over time. We've seen people radicalize and become more intense and more convicted in their beliefs, as we've seen others kind of age out, so to speak. So by no means is this a monolith, but that's also what makes it so challenging, is that there isn't one typology for the type of person that goes over there, and that there isn't a silver bullet to countering these types of networks.
Islamic jihadists and white supremacists obviously have very different goals, but many of their tactics are similar. Have the white supremacists copied the jihadist playbook when it comes to recruiting over social media, and how critical is social media for recruitment and financing?
Yeah, so social media is critical to pretty much everything we do, right, in the world today. You know, there's no Fortune 500 company that's without an active social media presence. And it's the same for any type of non-state actor, you know, whether that's an NGO or a terrorist group. And yeah, these guys have figured out, you know, how to recruit vulnerable individuals to their group, how to spread their propaganda online, much of the jihadis have done. And I think actually the radicalization and the emulation of tactics, techniques, and procedures goes both ways. In many ways, the jihadis copied off of white supremacist extremists in adopting this model of leaderless resistance, or leaderless jihad, as they called it. And in turn, white supremacist extremists have watched what happens on the battlefield in Iraq and Afghanistan and attempted to copy some of those tactics. Indeed, many of the fighters we're concerned about have prior military experience in armed forces, whether that's the American military or the Canadian or other kind of military. So they bring with them a certain set of experience, and they're always looking to adapt, evolve, and figure out what works best in these different contexts.
Do you think a case of one-upsmanship exists between jihadists and white supremacists, where one group will see the other post a violent attack on video, and then the other tries to emulate that one?
I think we are seeing some of that, you know, particularly if you look at what happened in Christchurch and then Sri Lanka. Even if that's not the original intention of the attacker, this kind of online environment and all these quote-unquote fanboys that engage in kind of social media activity parrot and echo these sentiments. And so there is a yin and yang, and I think that's really dangerous because as one drives the next and one attempts to outdo the next, as we saw with Brenton Tarrant, the Christchurch attacker, he upped the stakes by live streaming his attack. And so we're concerned that that's going to happen again, or that the number of people killed becomes what's focused on, right? And they're as both sides try to achieve higher body counts or higher lethality rates, which is really concerning.
YouTube and other internet sites have been infiltrated with white supremacist recruiting videos. What are these groups using other sites for primary communication and recruitment, and how helpful is that to law enforcement?
Yeah, so there's Gab, there's 8chan, there's a number of sites, there's Telegram. How hopeful is it? You know, unfortunately, law enforcement and intelligence agencies have been one or two steps behind, and that's just the nature of the business, because they come from more kind of cumbersome bureaucratic backgrounds, and these networks are a bit more nimble and able to kind of get out ahead. And as some of these sites are shut down, other ones pop up. A little bit remiss to use the cliche, but it is like whack-a-mole, right, where you shut one down and the next one pops up. And so it's very difficult to counter. It's very difficult to predict where these individuals and networks will go next.
Are you seeing enough movement not just from Washington, but from the various tech companies to quash this type of behavior?
You know, we've seen some, and that's encouraging, but I don't think we've seen enough. I don't think many tech companies understand the gravity of the threat. And again, that's not to paint them all with a broad brush, because they are trying to respond to a number of different kind of emergencies, right? This being simply one of them. We have seen Facebook and others kind of come out with their own definition of what terrorism is, and my hat's off. They know that these are vile individuals and that they shouldn't be treated with a double standard, right? So jihadis or white supremacist extremists or incels or whatever the ideology is that's motivating political violence needs to be countered and needs to be kept off these platforms.
You're listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks, and we're talking about the rise in white supremacist groups with Colin Clark, a senior research fellow at the Soufan Center. Any movement of consequence needs money. Where do white supremacist groups get their financing, and how critical are cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin for these groups?
They're becoming increasingly more relevant, Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. Crowdfunding is a popular method, and so again, we see that these are individuals that are constantly thinking two or three steps ahead. We've seen white supremacist extremists accrue wealth through both licit and illicit sources of finance. We've seen them accrue, move, and store wealth through various means. But as payment processors curb access to their platforms, the groups have relied on, you know, as you mentioned, cryptocurrencies and other alternatives to fiat currency. And again, that's something that it requires, you know, a range of stakeholders to get involved, not only governments, but also the private sector, you know, and these various partnerships that we've put together in the past.
I've been reading about U.S. cyber warfare moves against ISIS, infiltrating ISIS networks, dropping malware in its servers, looking for folders with key data like encryption keys and passwords. How effective would cyber warfare be against WSE groups? Are they as technologically sophisticated as ISIS?
You know, I would argue that they are. I'd say that there's this kind of stereotype we have of a kind of backward-thinking, uneducated, you know, for lack of a better term, quote-unquote, a redneck. But I'd say that a typology is has remained elusive, and I think it's wrong to kind of to think of it in those terms. Yeah, many of these individuals are digital natives. So I think cyber warfare would be effective. But at the same time, we can't put the cart before the horse. We don't have the authorities or the laws or the policies to go after these groups until they're actually designated as such. ISIS is a different animal. ISIS has been designated by the United States as a foreign terrorist organization. But many of these other networks are operating in the shadows and you know, in some ways kind of have remained below the radar because they haven't been officially designated.
And in your report, you mentioned the fact that the UK and Canada have sanctioned transnational WSE groups as foreign terrorist organizations. How would a move like that benefit the U.S. and local law enforcement in pursuing these groups?
Well, it allows, you know, the United States to have the resources to block the movement of assets of those designated. It allows the Department of Justice to prosecute individuals for providing material support to designated groups. So it opens up a whole array of options that we're lacking now but desperately need.
How paltry are these resources? And have we seen any of that change at all with the amplitude in the number of attacks over the past couple of years?
So I think the needle is moving, but it's moving too slow for many, including myself. I don't know how many more attacks we have to see before the sense of urgency is elevated. I think DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, did a nice job releasing its latest counterterrorism strategy, where it does highlight the importance of combating white supremacist extremist groups. But again, that's one agency in a broad government, and for too long, you know, we've been, I call it the 9/11 effect. We were hit so hard on 9/11 that we've been unable to shake this focus on just Al-Qaeda and just the Islamic State. And it's not either or, right? It's we need to be going after them all at the same time.
Pretty staggering when you look at the numbers of white supremacist attacks in the U.S. over the past 15 years, and your report really gets into that. Like you said, I think a lot of people really worry about Islamic jihadist attacks following 9/11, but the burden of the attacks have really fallen on white supremacists since that time.
Yeah, no question, and the data proves that and bears that out. But I think there's kind of there's other elements at play. There's culture, there's politics, there's history, right? And so that's something that we've got to work hard to overcome. And part of that is education, right? And kind of explaining to people and doing what we're doing with this report of saying, look, you know, we're agnostic to what motivates these people. If it's jihadists that are killing people, we'll be writing about them. If it's white supremacist extremists, we'll be writing about them and trying to shine a light on these networks in order to make sure that they receive no quarter on U.S. soil or elsewhere.
Do you think if U.S. law enforcement had the proper funding for the resources it needs to go after WSEs, that it would be just as effective in limiting those attacks as it has against Islamic jihadists since 9/11?
I do think so. I mean, I think we have world-class intelligence and law enforcement. Unfortunately, there's often a lag effect, right? By the time you get the money, you put together these teams, you figure out who to go after, it takes some time to get up and running. You know, agencies like the FBI are doing a phenomenal job, and I'm incredibly thankful that we have the FBI and others that are already disrupting major plots. But we need a more concerted, full-throated effort.
How does the international community fare by comparison in the battle against WSEs?
Yeah, it's a mixed bag, really. You know, I think Germany, the UK, Canada, and others have a different history, and so they've approached it in a different way. I think rather than talking about these countries individually, we should be talking about the threat in the same way we do with ISIS, which is we talk about the global coalition to counter ISIS, right? We should have a global coalition to counter white supremacist extremism because it presents itself in much the same way.
Now, it's very interesting with ISIS. The caliphate was destroyed in Syria, also in Iraq, but yet ISIS continues, and it's shown up in other parts of the world, whether it's Asia or Africa, as well as the Middle East. Are we looking at the same situation with white supremacists? Perhaps they could be curtailed in large degree, but you'll never fully get rid of them?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's most likely. This is about mitigating, not fully defeating, if we're being honest with ourselves. Unfortunately, this, you know, very virulent ideology exists. It spreads online. And again, I think, you know, it's a long-term strategy, but education is critical. And in the meantime, you know, we need to be disrupting plots. We need to be, you know, capturing and prosecuting those that seek to do harm in the name of this hateful ideology.
Fascinating research. Colin, thank you so much for coming back on The Crisis Next Door.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
We've been joined by Colin Clark, Senior Research Fellow at the Soufan Center and author of After the Caliphate, The Islamic State and the Future Terrorist Diaspora. I'm Jason Brooks. Thank you for listening to The Crisis Next Door. Till next time.
The Crisis Next Door with host Jason Brooks is produced weekly. If you have any thoughts for Jason, email him at tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com. Again, that's tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com.
Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app, the biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.